Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Spend any time in Washington, D.C., and you'll learn that there are some jobs that perhaps don't make much of a difference. One that does is the Department of Agriculture's Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment. The person holding that job oversees the Natural Resource Conservation Service and the U.S. Forest Service, which manages almost 200 million acres of federal land. In August of last year, at age 45, Robert Bonney was confirmed by the United States Senate to take on that job. Robert, many thanks for joining us from Washington on Home Ground.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
Let's talk a little about your background. What did your folks do? Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up on a farm in Prospect, Kentucky. I've always been interested in the outdoors, spent a lot of time outdoors as a kid, and ended up getting myself to forestry school at Duke University. I got a degree in forestry and also resource economics. And then I went and worked for an organization called Environmental Defense Fund. I was there for 14 years. I led their efforts around conservation incentives. We worked with farmers, ranchers, forest owners to protect habitat through voluntary incentives. And I joined the administration with Secretary Vilsack in 2009.
So if someone asked if you had hands-on experience with agriculture, it sounds like the answer is yes.
Yeah, I have. And I've also, my family's also owned forest land for over a century in South Carolina. That's what really got me interested in forests. And so I've been involved in the management of that property as well, around forest management and endangered species and lots of other issues.
When you studied forestry in college, what did you learn that you didn't know from growing up on a farm?
Well, I think the thing that really interested me most was how you balance, whether it's wildlife conservation, timber management, watershed conservation, how you balance those, particularly on private lands, how you make it work for private landowners so that they've got their operations are economically viable, but at the same time they're good stewards. And that's the thing that really interested me and still interests me today.
I did a little research, and the report I saw from Duke University, which you attended, said that you had done work on an endangered species developing incentives for landowners. Can you summarize that work briefly?
My family has this endangered species on their property. There are a lot of landowners in the southeast. It's a species called the red-cockaded woodpecker. A lot of landowners that were concerned in the wake of the spotted owl that if they managed their lands in certain ways that would benefit those species, that they would get additional regulation under the Endangered Species Act. And so there were landowners actually out removing habitat as a result of that. And so what we did at Environmental Defense Fund was we created a new tool in partnership with landowners and Fish and Wildlife Service and others called Safe Harbor that would allow landowners to do good things for endangered species, but give them assurances that if they did those things, they wouldn't be penalized with additional regulation. And so here's a tool where you can encourage voluntary conservation. Landowners win by having more flexibility in how they manage their lands. There are more woodpeckers today as a result of this. It's working not only there, it's working for a bunch of other species. It's actually something we're working on now at USDA, where we're combining our financial incentive programs with these types of programs that provide assurances to landowners.
Let's talk a little about the Natural Resource Conservation Service that you oversee as part of your job. I think out here that's not as well known broadly as the Forest Service. What does it do, and what's your responsibility in relation to it?
My job oversees the broad policies related to the NRCS. NRCS is an agency that used to be called the Soil Conservation Service, and so many folks may know the old Soil Conservation Service. And NRCS is critical when it comes to conservation of private working lands. NRCS spends between $4 and $5 billion a year generally on working lands programs, conservation easements, stewardship programs on private lands. That's done in partnership with farmers, ranchers, forest landowners. We work with landowners to put in place practices that protect wildlife, that protect water quality, that improve agricultural productivity and efficiency. We work with livestock grazers to improve productivity and reduce soil erosion on their lands. We also do work with forest owners. As I mentioned, we do a lot of work with conservation easements. All this work is cost shared, so we put up a portion of the costs, but generally landowners or other partners are also investing in these practices. And we're working in states across the country. We've got state conservationists with district offices in all the states. We work with your local conservation districts, and we're doing a lot of work to target these dollars in ways that, you know, put the right practices, the right conservation practices on the right lands.
It's fair to say, I think you'd agree, that at least in the West, farmers and ranchers are often skeptical about federal programs, quote unquote. My sense is the Soil Conservation Service, if that was the previous name, had pretty good credibility and engagement with the ag community.
We've got great relationships with the agricultural community. I think they recognize us as a resource, not only to provide some financial incentives, but also to provide technical assistance around how to manage your lands in ways that not only are productive and economically viable, but also protect the environment. So, and we're also doing a lot of work. I mentioned some of the endangered species work. NRCS is doing some really good work around sage grouse, for example. We're working cooperatively with landowners, providing them technical assistance, providing them financial assistance, some of these assurances I talked about. And so we're often willing or able to work with landowners on some difficult issues, but do it in a way that's cooperative, that's voluntary, and I think at the end of the day, produces results.
Let's talk about the Forest Service, better known here. And let me take a step back from some specific issues and sort of do an overview comment. There are tens of millions of people in the West that are affected by federal policies on Forest Service land, as you know well. Jobs in natural resources, jobs in recreation, and those have serious local and regional economic impacts. Then, there are the life support systems our forests supply, clean water, clean air, wildlife habitat, and again, major local and regional impacts. A lot of polarization around these issues and interests. My question is, why would a sane, reasonably young man seek a job with that kind of responsibility?
I find the Forest Service not only a fabulous agency to work with wonderful people, but I think the issues, as you've ably outlined them, are critically important to people's lives. And I think we can do a lot of good. And I'm optimistic about our ability to manage our forests in ways that restore those forests so that they're more resilient, provide recreational opportunities, provide wood products, wilderness experiences. And it's a great job. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, let's talk about some of those specifics. You talked about restoration, and in your Senate testimony, that is your opening statement when you were being assessed for this job, you talked about restoration quite a bit. How do you see that issue in terms of what needs to be restored in our national forests and why?
If you look at the national forests, and let's focus on the West, you know, we've got 40 million acres, north of 40 million acres, that have been impacted severely by the bark beetle. We've got challenges related to fire. We've got a fire season that's 60 to 80 days longer than it used to be. We're seeing twice as many acres burned. We're now burning about 7.5 million acres a year. We used to burn less than half of that. We're seeing challenges related to the Forest Service's budget resources related to fire. And I think those are challenges that we've got to address. My Senate testimony, the work that Secretary Vilsack has done and that I am doing now, is focused heavily on ways that we can manage and restore those forests so they're more resilient to fire, more resilient to insects and disease, provide the recreational opportunities and other experience that people demand. You know, forests, as you've pointed out, forest policy has been very controversial, but I think there's a growing recognition amongst environmentalists, amongst forest industry, amongst local communities, that there are serious threats facing our forests and that we need to come together to actually address those threats and that we can do it in a way that actually provides jobs and wood, but also the environmental benefits and services that we want from our forests.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Undersecretary of Agriculture Robert Bonney. Let's talk a little more in detail about that. Some of the critics of the idea of restoration to achieve these goals that you've outlined are as follows. First of all, there are some prominent voices in terms of at least some people in the environmental community who would argue that beetle kill is, quote unquote, a natural phenomenon, and therefore we should leave it alone and let it run its course. What's your sense for that?
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I do know there are a number of scientists that believe that a beetle kill at the scale that we're seeing is potentially linked to climate change because of the warmer winters that we're seeing across large parts of the West. But I think in addition, you know, I was back in Montana a couple weeks ago, was with the governor and the watershed there and the 10-mile watershed near Helena. That's an area where you have significant beetle-killed timber. And you've also got people that live in that landscape adjacent to the national forest. The community gets their water from that watershed. There are things we can do to manage that ecosystem that continue to produce clean water, continue to produce wildlife habitat, but that lower the fire risk there, and do it in a way that actually provides jobs and opportunity for local businesses. That's the type of approach we're talking about, and we want to do this in a collaborative way. The Forest Service is involved in a number of efforts in Montana and elsewhere where we're bringing people to the table, putting together solutions that has public buy-in from a broad spectrum of stakeholders, and that's how we're going to have to solve this. We're going to have to come together in these collaborative efforts to work on this issue.
Our listeners perhaps know, but I should clarify, that I did facilitate the 10-mile watershed process that you've just addressed, Secretary Bonnie, and with part of my time I do mediation for these collaborative groups. So that should just be on the record. Some critics of collaboration argue that not everybody's at the table, and therefore that collaboratives really cut out some interests and perhaps are illegitimate. What do you say to that?
First thing I would say is everybody is invited to be at the table. We want communities, we want environmentalists, we want forest industry. We want everybody at the table. We think those are the best solutions are going to come out of that collaborative approach. Part of the way I'd answer that question as well is to say, you know, the alternative is, and this is an alternative that I think the Forest Service was criticized for decades ago, was sort of viewing itself as the experts and making decisions with less public input. You know, the alternative where the Forest Service goes and puts together a plan and then puts it out for public comment and takes public comment and then goes back into its behind the curtain in the black box and works out the final solution and then presents it to the community is not one that's going to work particularly well. A solution that is developed in partnership with stakeholders, in partnership with folks who have an interest in the outcome, whether it's a 10-mile watershed, whether it's other national forests, whether it's a plan for a national forest, those types of approaches that involve collaboration, I think at the end of the day, are going to have greater public input. They're going to be better from a resource standpoint because we're going to take into account more views. So not everybody is happy with this type of approach, as you point out, but I think it's a type of approach which has significant benefits relative to the alternative.
Just on one of the issues that you raised in your testimony, you talked about the risk of catastrophic wildfire, and earlier in this conversation you talked about the increase in fires. Again, some critics on the environmental side might say fire is a natural process, we should let it run its course, that fire suppression over decades of Forest Service management has had negative consequences. What's your sense for that argument?
Well, fire is a natural process, and in the forests in Montana and throughout the Inland West, fire was a natural process. It was also a process that Native Americans used as well to manage the forest. But the impacts that we're seeing now, we're seeing significantly not only more acres burning, but we're seeing significantly larger fires. We're seeing really destructive fires. And we're seeing fires that put people at risk, that put property at risk, that don't confine themselves to the national forests. We've got neighborhoods, communities living in the wildland urban interface. And so I think there's no doubt that we have to address this challenge. And no one here is talking about, you know, doing management in wilderness areas or significant management in roadless areas or those types of things. What we're largely talking about is a subset of the national forest system where we can go out, do management in a way that protects the environmental values of those forests. And at the same time, I think, you know, there are a lot of places where we're going to be able to get these low-intensity fires back into those systems in a way that I think will allow for the conservation of watersheds, wildlife, and other things. And so, there's opportunities, I think, to work together and to put fire in a place where it's better both ecologically, but also that it protects all the other values that we have to worry about.
I mentioned critics of collaboration from some in the conservation community. Of course, I should emphasize there are major conservation players at the table, but there are also critics from industry side. Montana's had serious collaboration for 8 or 9 years, and those critics say Conversation's good, common ground policies sound good, but we're not seeing any more saw logs getting to the mill, and our mills are in jeopardy. They say we've got to produce more. What do you say?
I do think we have to produce more, and I think the viabilities of those mills is important. Now, talk about restoration. If we want to get the restoration work done, and that's not just forest management, that's roads work, that's watershed work, other things, we actually need the industry as a partner. So the viability of the forest industry is important to achieving our environmental goals on the national forest system. And I understand the critics from the industrial side. Their concern is that they invest in collaboration. They get a lot of people to the table, and that there are a few outliers at the end of the day that come in and sue in the courts. And, you know, that's a strong concern of many folks in the industry. I think our response to that is the best way to address that is to bring people together, is to work on collaboration, and to be able to go into court with a sizable chunk of the conservation community, sizable chunk of the environmental community, local communities with you. And I think over time, we're going to win those battles more than we lose them. I think there's frustration in the industry because this has taken some time. And you see that nowhere more so than in Montana. Montana's had the biggest challenges in this area. But I think this is the course that we're on now is the best course. Over time, I'm confident we're going to be successful. It's important that we do it in a way that we get enough, that we do it quickly enough that we keep those mills in business.
You're listening to Home Ground, and this is Brian Kahn. We're talking with Undersecretary of Agriculture Robert Bonney about the United States Forest Service and forest policy management. Now, President Obama has just announced with some fanfare a new approach to the budgeting for wildfires. Is that relevant to our discussion about getting more work done on the ground or not?
Absolutely. It's critical to getting more work done on the ground.
Can you summarize his proposal?
Absolutely. So, let me talk about the way fire is budgeted now very quickly. Basically, the Forest Service kind of has two pots of money that it fights fires with. One is preparedness, and you can think about that as kind of getting ready for the fire season. It's contracts, it's the people we need, the firefighters, those types of things. Then we have a part of our budget that's called the suppression budget. When we have really bad years, we tend to run out of suppression dollars, and we have to borrow funds from other parts of the budget, from forest management, from forest restoration, from research, from other things that are critically important for our ability to get work done in the woods. So in 7 of the last 10 years, we've had to borrow money from other parts of the Forest Service budget to fight fire because we're treating fire as a normal expense. And as I mentioned earlier, the number of fires we're seeing has grown. The acreage has doubled. If you talk to Forest Service researchers, they'll tell you that it may double again by the middle of the next century. And so if we don't find a new way to budget for fire, we're going to have significant challenges in the organization being able to fulfill its mission, including the type of forest management that can prevent wildfires or reduce their impact. And so what the president has proposed is to treat wildfires like we treat other natural disasters. When FEMA responds to a hurricane, tornadoes, floods, those sorts of things, it has a pool of money that it can draw from that's outside of its normal operating budget. That's what the president's proposing for the Forest Service. When we run through those suppression dollars that we have, we'll have another source of money that we can draw on to continue to fight those fires. We're always going to provide the resources we need to fight those fires, but we don't want to have to rob Peter to pay Paul. And this budget proposal is going to fix that. It's also going to provide us increased flexibility and resources to be able to do the management upfront that will reduce the severity of fires.
Let me ask you one other question about proposals, or in this case, legislation that's been passed and signed into law. The Farm Bill had significant provisions for the Forest Service. One, my summary would be outlining a pretty aggressive program of hazardous fuels reduction, A. B, having a, I think it's a categorical exclusion from up to 3,000 acres, meaning an expedited environmental analysis, if it was a product of a collaborative process. Any comments on those two elements of the Farm Bill?
Yeah, I think this is an area where we look to working with our collaboratives. Governors have an important voice in this. I know Governor Bullock's team is already putting together their submissions. They can submit areas that they want to have these areas considered for that have insects and disease. You can, as you point out, we can get additional tools related to streamlining some of the analysis related to those sales in those areas. We think there are a lot of places where there are collaboratives on the ground that we can use these new tools. I think our hope over the long term is to look to larger landscapes. There is a 3,000-acre categorical exclusion in the legislation, as you point out. We think that's going to be useful in a number of places. But I think we want to get to a place where we're doing larger scale projects of on the orders of 10,000 acres, hundreds of thousands of acres, where we can provide certainty to the industry related to timber supply, but we can also demonstrate to the environmental community and conservation community that there are going to be a lot of watershed benefits, that there are things we can do related to road improvements, culverts, those types of things. And our hope is by moving towards broader projects that we'll be able to get more work done, both on the forest management side, but also on the restoration and resilience side.
My experience is there's a split within the agency in terms of the receptivity to the idea of collaboratives, because you're giving quote-unquote authority to make serious recommendations and potentially influencing decisions to quote-unquote lay people. And my experience is some people in the Forest Service really get it. The chief we had on this show, he talked very strongly about collaboration being the way to do business in the 21st century for the Forest Service. You oversee the agency. I would say there's a serious problem in part in the culture of some members of the Forest Service who don't want to work in that way. What do you say about that, and what can you do about it in your job?
Well, I think at the end of the day, collaborative efforts that are happening on the ground are starting to actually prove themselves up, and we're starting to demonstrate that we can get more work done through these type of approaches. We have a large effort right now in Arizona, for example, which is over... we're putting together an environmental impact statement on over 600,000 acres there. We have an effort in the Black Hills, South Dakota, Wyoming, where we've got an effort around 200,000 acres and have put together a project there. And I think the agency is starting to see that these types of approaches are a more efficient way to spend our limited resources and that they will produce results. I'm sure there are differing opinions within the agency about collaboration, but I do think that overwhelmingly the agency is seeing this as a tool that's going to work, that's going to allow them to get their work done. And the Forest Service, I think, is getting much better at being able to provide technical assistance to folks, to be able to provide expertise, but also to facilitate the type of conversations that at the end of the day will allow us to get more work done. And I think, you know, as I said, at the end of the day, I think the agency will strongly support that.
Let's use the time we have left to talk about climate change. For 4 years, I think you were Secretary Vilsack's chief climate change advisor. First, that's still controversial in the United States. It doesn't seem to be controversial in Europe or Asia that climate change is underway and humans are inducing a significant portion of it. What's your sense for the balance of the science in the argument?
I think the science is very clear. And, you know, the president has said that last summer when he put out his climate action plan. I'm not a scientist myself, but I've been around this issue for a long time. I think the science is very clear. It's overwhelming that the climate has changed, that humans are an important cause of it, and that if we don't change direction, that there are significant consequences to that. And I think we're starting to see some of those consequences out in the in our forests and elsewhere. I think the good news is, and the work that we do at the Department of Agriculture, farmers, ranchers, forest landowners have always demonstrated that they can adapt to new situations. We can do the same thing here, and I think our job at the Department of Agriculture is to provide landowners, land managers, and others the tools to be able to do that.
How do you overcome skepticism? In other words, I think it's fair to say the public opinion polls in America show that almost half or 40% of people are skeptical about climate change. You're doing outreach to landowners, ranchers, forest owners saying it's coming, it's here, you need to adapt. What kind of reception are you getting, or is it too early to judge the effectiveness of your programs?
Well, I don't think it's too early. You know, it's interesting. We obviously had a very bad drought in 2012. We're having difficult drought conditions in parts of the West and particularly in California right now. I think landowners are seeing this. Farmers and ranchers are seeing the impacts, forest landowners as well. And I think they are very open to ways that they can manage their land so that they're more resilient in the face of climate change. And so we don't have to get into a debate with landowners about what causes climate change, but We actually find that a lot of folks out in the field recognize that something's changing here, and they see it in their everyday lives. They see areas where we can plant crops that we didn't used to be able to because of changing climate. They see flood. They see drought. Can we link all those things to climate change? No, we can't link any one of those individual things to climate change. But I do think there's a receptivity out there. One of the interesting things about the 2012 drought we learned is that there were a couple things that actually helped landowners. There were some landowners that did really well in the drought, considering the challenges they faced. One is new seed technology. So new drought-resistant variety of seeds was helpful to folks. The other thing is landowners that used good conservation practices, whether that's conservation tillage, cover crops, or other things that preserve soil moisture and that reduce erosion and protect our soils, those farmers and ranchers actually did pretty well. And I think that type of information is of a lot of interest to our folks out in the field. And so we're finding quite a lot of receptivity to our ability to provide information to producers.
I said at the top of the show that your job makes a difference. What's your sense for it? And if you feel you are making a difference, tell us how in nuts and bolts terms.
Well, I mean, if the one thing I've learned from being in conservation is that we accomplish nothing alone. We only do it in partnership with others. I've been privileged to work with Secretary Vilsack and other folks in the Department of Agriculture and folks across the ground. What I think we can achieve on the Forest Service side is I think we can create a greater public understanding and acceptance for the type of work we need to do in the woods, and that we can increase the amount of work we do in the woods that make our forests both more resilient, producing better environmental goods, but also producing wood and economic opportunities for rural communities. On the Natural Resources Conservation Service side, I think we can demonstrate that we can solve problems through voluntary incentives, that we can protect water quality, that we can protect endangered species, that we can even protect the climate change through the things we do on the ground, and that we'll do that in a way that's also recognizes that we need to spend the taxpayer dollars in a focused way and in a smart way.
Let me ask you a personal question. As an American citizen, why does any of that matter to you?
Well, it matters because our society relies so much on the environmental goods and other services that come from our lands. If you're concerned about clean water, if you're concerned about the air you breathe, if you're concerned about wildlife, what our farmers and ranchers do is critically important to those things. Same thing on with our Forest Service. How we manage our national forest lands are critical for our communities, both clean water, environmental services that those forests provide, but also the economic opportunity. And you know, that's what excites me about going to work every day.
Robert Bonney, I very much forget to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week.
Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.